Field gave his compliments to Thompson and selected a more practical man as chief engineer for the project. This was Edward Whitehouse, who didn't believe in preposterous, invisible flying force fields. For him, electric charges just shot out from the metals inside a battery and poured down the wire. There was no need for lurking force fields to fly alongside and speed them ahead. Even better, Whitehouse was able to help Field in another, somewhat delicate matter. For Field was not quite as rich as everyone believed. He'd made a fortune, but not all of his subsequent investments had done well, and unless he got funding for his cable project and quickly, he'd have to return to New York in disgrace. He couldn't fund the project on his own. He couldn't fund a tenth of it, or even a hundredth. No sign of hesitancy or uncertainty could be made public until his investors were in hand. Whitehouse was the ideal man to guarantee that no questions were raised. He used threats to make sure that the handful of young scientists who supported Thompson's hypothesis stayed quiet or recanted. He even, humiliatingly, brought the elder Michael Faraday to a public meeting to back Field's project. Faraday had been suffering increasing bursts of confusion over the years, possibly due to mercury fumes coming from the floorboards of his laboratory, which can affect the brain if inhaled over long periods, and Whitehouse had carefully prepared him. Faraday's great strength was experimentation, everyone knew that, and Whitehouse seems to have misled Faraday about experimental evidence, suggesting there were flaws in Thompson's calculations. Under Whitehouse's pressure, Faraday gave an ambiguous statement suggesting that Thompson hadn't been entirely correct. In a move that would do 21st century biotech venture capitalists proud, Whitehouse and Field spun that statement to give the impression that they had Faraday's full support for their narrow cable with only a thin layer of insulation. Respected public figures such as Arnold Thackeray started buying shares. Soon Field had enough cash for the cable factories to run full-time and for negotiations with the Admiralty and the American Navy to proceed. Thompson realized his idol Faraday was being manipulated, but what could he do? He was convinced he was right, but recognized that all he had was still only a theory. The cable project had too much momentum, and he was now ignored. Whitehouse blocked his letters to Field. When Thompson proposed an improved transmitter for the cable, Whitehouse ridiculed it and refused any company funds to build it. On June 10, 1858, the British battleship Agamemnon and the U.S. Navy's Niagara sailed from Plymouth in England, ready to lay the cable. There had been an earlier try in 1857, but the cable had snapped in water too deep to dredge it up. Taking into account the insulation and the metal sheath, the cable weighed so much, almost a ton per mile, that no single ship could hold enough. So the two vessels headed to a central rendezvous, where they would splice together the two halves and then sail in opposite directions, one to Ireland, one to Newfoundland, playing the cable out between them. Field was on board the Agamemnon, and so was a tough chief engineer, Charles Bright, but when it came time to sail, Whitehouse didn't show up. The British Navy had lost many big ships in Atlantic storms over the years, and Whitehouse knew it never hurt to be too careful. He also wanted to avoid William Thompson, who had talked his way on board. Thompson knew that Field didn't believe his untested deductions, but he also wanted the chance to show that his and Faraday's ideas really were true. Also, he liked Cyrus Field and was going to help him succeed, whether he wanted it or not. Whitehouse had happily bullied Thompson in their correspondence, but he knew of Thompson's intellectual reputation and was not about to dare having a technical argument with him in front of Field. Anyone who joked about Whitehouse's unnecessary caution would have changed his view when the storm of late June 1858 broke. It was one of the worst recorded in the North Atlantic in the 19th century. The Agamemnon's captain, George Preedy, seems not to have worried too much when his ship tilted sideways so far its mast dragged in the bursting waves. But when its coal supplies started flying up through the splintering deck, and then the tons of cable started following them, he did confide to a London Times correspondent on board that it was not, perhaps, ideal weather for laying a telegraph line.